dung fi nuan nuan ơi.
This song is called Looking for Love at the Rocket Festival, of course. And truly, the most bonkers experience of our Music Planet Global Outreach programme was a visit to the Yazathon Rocket Festival in Thailand. It's not an event noted for its adherence to the concept of health and safety, although huge crowds are drawn to watch teams of people fooling with high explosive, and it gets national television coverage. The Rocket Festival begins with a carnival, a street parade, extravagant floats, and lots of music. On the night before the big day, the rocket competition itself, I went to check on one of the teams, known as the Students of Liquor, as they made the final preparations to their missiles. And it was only at this encounter that I realised that the Yazathon Rocket Festival was about more than a few fireworks let off from a pop bottle. The rockets are about 30 feet long, and just before their launch, I found the Students of Liquor priming theirs.
How do you do? I'm Andy from the BBC. May we talk to you for the radio? How much gunpowder, how much explosive in weight, how many kilograms does he put in this?
120 kilograms.
Oh, it's 120 kilograms.
Of explosive?
Yeah.
What speed does this reach when it blasts off?
It's about 8 kilometers.
The speed they don't know, but they know that they can go very high, about 8 kilometers.
8 kilometers high?
Yes.
So I'm going now. And he's just run out the front of the tent to see how that launch from one of his competitors has fared. Why is your team called the Students of Liquor?
They drink a lot.
Thank you very much. Good luck to you. Don't worry about the bangs in the background. That's to whip up the hysteria. The fuse is lit. The big one's about to go. Not one among them would pass a breathalyzer test. And they're all leaping around, getting very ecstatic as these bangers go off. Here we go! Here we go! Whoa! Hell! It's gone. It spirals. The crowd like it spiraling. Still in vision, still climbing. Its engine's still burning as it disappears through a second cloud, still on its ascent. Unbelievable. 8 kilometres that can reach, 5 miles high. The Thai authorities must have to clear this area of Thai airspace so that this event can happen. There's no question of that. Otherwise, if you're on a commercial airliner, one of those, you could be sitting there wondering what to do with your hot towel when one of those could come past the window. The Students of Liquor, still capable of standing, are making their way, modestly but triumphantly, back to their drinking tent. Excellent.
Incineration at the Thailand Rocket Festival. Those 20 minutes were produced by Dean Craven. So we come to the second half of tonight's equally explosive BBC Proms concert, a special Human Planet Prom, with the BBC Concert Orchestra playing highlights from Nitin Sawhney's music for the TV series. Plus, there are 5 groups from around the world who are featured in Radio 3's Music Planet. But we start the second half with something a little different, and to say a little different may be understating it. In front of me on the platform are members of the BBC Concert Orchestra clutching instruments made out of all sorts of recycled materials. It's the Scrap Heap Orchestra, and in a moment, the conductor Charles Hazelwood will be telling us all about the project. But taking a look around, I can see a bass drum, an enormous industrial-looking cylindrical grinding drum which is going to be played with wooden spoons. And here comes Charles Hazelwood to tell us more.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to part two of this Human Planet Prom. One of the great things I think that the amazing TV series Human Planet has reminded us is how adaptable and resourceful human beings can be. And those two words, adaptable and resourceful, are right at the heart of what we offer to you now. About just under 3 months ago, I pulled together a group of leading makers of musical instruments in the UK. And I said to them, OK, guys, I want a new orchestra of instruments from you. There's only one rule, though. All the materials you use must ideally not be the conventional ones, and most certainly must have been sourced from a scrapyard or a recycling depot. In other words, other people's waste. Could such a thing be done? Well, here we are, nearly 3 months later, on the stage at the Royal Albert Hall, at the BBC Proms, no less, with an entire orchestra of instruments made entirely from scrap, stuff that maybe you threw away last month, ladies and gentlemen. Here it is on stage, and it's about to make, I hope, beautiful poetry. Now, if you're interested in following the journey, which has been extraordinary, both painful and wondrous over the last 3 months, we've made a film about it, which will be on BBC Four television in the early autumn. It's called, not surprisingly, Scrap Heap Orchestra. Right, let me talk you through some of the materials that have been garnered to musical use. The violin and the viola section, Cynthia's violin here, for instance, is made out of a piece of toilet waste pipe, ladies and gentlemen. It has been cleaned. And the bow, because we haven't just stopped with the instruments, you know, the other sort of pieces of apparatus, such as the bow, that bow started out life as an arrow. Now, there's another bow in the second violin somewhere, which is made of a coat hanger. There it is. Look at that. A rather good use. A great use for a coat hanger, much better than what it was designed for. Now, the cello's here. Look at this. Ben is playing an instrument made out of plywood and two washing up bowls. His bow is made out of bicycle spokes. Imagine that. Matthew behind him, another cellist. His cello is made primarily from the petrol tank of a medium-priced popular family car. We only have two basses. That's more than enough for our purposes. Rick's bass is made a combination of a Jaguar car bonnet and part of a water cylinder. Andy's bass, carrying on the aquatic theme, is actually made out of a zinc bathtub. Sort of... It really is a zinc bathtub, ladies and gentlemen. A remarkably resonant body it makes, actually, and it's sort of strapped to part of a yacht mast. Now, have a look at the woodwind instruments. A couple of highlights there. Liz is playing a bassoon, which is made almost entirely from a shower cubicle. And Ileana, our principal flute, she's playing a flute which is made from shower curtain tubing. But the really interesting part here is the intricacy of the keys. How do you make keys that are going to work on a very sophisticated woodwind instrument? Well, those keys are made entirely from old cutlery. Moving on to the brass. Wonderful array there, as you can see. Noteworthy, perhaps, the trombones. A lot of plumbing material involved in the trombones. You're perhaps not surprised to hear that. But in addition... a certain amount of food processing, I think, has gone into that. Obviously, also a bit of a light fitting. But the tuba, pièce de résistance, don't you think? Look at that tuba, ladies and gentlemen. You'll no doubt be happy to know that that's made almost entirely from ventilation duct from a local burger joint. The French horns, ladies and gentlemen, made almost entirely of papier-mâché. Fancy that. And then the percussion. My goodness me, what percussion we have in store for you. First of all, the kettle drums. The one on the left there is made entirely, as you can see, from a cement mixer. Very kind of you to clap. It takes up time. The one on the right is made up from a buoy. You know, it was literally seized out of the sea, cut in half, and it now makes rather a fantastic sound. A bass drum, you might just better see down here, is made from the most enormous truck wheel. Resourceful to the last, you see. But I must draw your attention to the cymbals. Who would have thought that a humble pair of cymbals would take such an enormous and inordinate number of different kind of gizmos to recreate? That was formerly a bed, as you can see. It now looks like something which Professor Brainstorm would be proud of, and it makes a very compelling and authentic sound of a cymbal. So I come back to the two words I mentioned at the start, adaptability and resourcefulness. I think first prize for adaptability must surely go to my esteemed musical colleagues on stage with me here. In most cases, they've had to almost entirely relearn their playing technique in order to make sense of these very unwieldy and strange instruments, which are heavier, feel different under the hands, feel different to blow down, you name it. So this bunch of artists, formerly known as the BBC Concert Orchestra, now known as the Scrap Heap Orchestra, please give them a big round of applause. So now to the resourcefulness part. Well, obviously that falls to the extraordinary band of instrument makers that we've had the great privilege to work with on this project. They really have gone the extra mile, in very many cases, presenting a prototype instrument to a member of the orchestra, which in some cases actually rendered that orchestral musician ill for a while. We're talking muscle strain, we're talking neck ache, we're talking shoulder problems, hand strain. So these makers had to go back to their laboratories, their workshops, time in and time out, to remake, to rethink, to go from a completely different direction. So I salute them for their extraordinary resourcefulness. Ladies and gentlemen, the makers, they're all up in that box there. So finally, what piece of music to showcase this unusual orchestra with? Well, it seemed to us there was only one piece that really fitted the bill, a piece which is full of heart, just like this project, but a piece which is also shot through with an awful lot of almost caustic vulgarity. That piece, ladies and gentlemen, is Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture, which has been rearranged, dare I say it, recycled by the brilliant Ian Gardner. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as you can probably imagine, these instruments don't stay in tune for very long, if at all, really. So we now have to retune again. I think it's worth doing. And can I just say to you that if you hear any kind of strange, sort of slightly tuneless moments in this piece, I can assure you it is not operator error.
Just a cello giving a few problems, but I think we're just about sorted. It's quite a comfort to know that any of the instruments play at all, really. Yep, Ben looks happy. Here we go.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, if you tuned in during the middle of that, you must be wondering what on earth has happened to Radio 3. We've gone environmentally friendly. That was the Scrap Heap Orchestra, the instruments made out of recycled materials, played by members of the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Charles Hazelwood. And that last little cheer there was for the instrument makers who are watching their instruments in action. I have to say, all the audience are standing in sheer admiration of the instruments and the players. I think the bedstead cymbal really brought the house down, provoking the most hilarity. Well, you need never fork out millions for a Stradivarius again. Simply pop down to your local tip. Well, after all that excitement, we need to clear the rubbish off the stage, by which I mean the scrapyard instruments, of course, to reset for the BBC Concert Orchestra's more conventional layout and instrumentation. Those cheers are for the instruments as they're being carried off the stage by their players. Well, we're also going to hear our next Music Planet artists shortly. They are Aya Khan. They come from Yakutsk, the capital of the Sakha Republic, which is in northeast Siberia. They're three women who play the khomus, which is a mouth harp or a Jew's harp, a traditional instrument associated with shamanism. It's said that the sound of the mouth harp can put you into a trance which can cure all sorts of psychological illnesses. Just what you need when you live in one of the coldest places on Earth. Can it cure frostbite, I wonder? Well, for Music Planet, Andy Kershaw travelled to Siberia and met Aya Khan's leader, Albina Degtyareva.
Наш народ считает себя частью природы. Мы считаем себя детьми природы.
Over the centuries, in order to survive, our people have had to live in harmony with nature. We've always taught our children how to do that. So when the men used to go out hunting, they used to ask a blessing from nature, so that they would be able to catch enough food to feed their families. And it's important, too, that we only take from nature what we actually need. That's our life. So we want to express that in music as well.
Now, you're from an area called the Sakha Republic in the Russian Federation. It's not an area which is very well known in the outside world. Tell us a little about it.
Yes, you're right. The Sakha Republic isn't very well known in the West. And actually, it's not very well known in the East either. And it's a very harsh climate, a continental climate with extremes of cold and heat. So in the winter, it can go right down to minus 60 degrees Celsius. And in the summer, we often get temperatures up to 35 or 38 degrees. But our nature there is unique. And the animal life is like nowhere else, too.
And how many people live there?
It's a vast territory. You can fit about five Frances into it.
Five times the size of France?
Yes, and at the same time, we have few people living in Sahara Republic. The population is about 1 million.
Good Lord.
So that's about one lake for every one person in the Republic.
And is it agricultural? Are you farmers?
There are two main peoples living in the Republic, the Yakuts, and they're known as horsemen, and the Evenkis, who are reindeer herders. People generally are self-sufficient, but of course, when people have extra, they take it to the market and sell it. But things are changing too. We have diamond mines in the Republic now.
Now, I notice hanging round your neck, you have your two Jews' harps, which you can hear there rattling in the background. Why is the Jews' harp such a popular instrument in your part of the world?
Of course, we do have other instruments, string instruments and drums, but by far the most beloved instrument with us is the hamuz, the Jew's harp. It's perfect for us, because we can play melodies on it, and we can imitate the sounds of nature too. Believe it or not, we can even declare our love for each other with the hamuz. And during the long, dark, depressing days of winter, when the climate is really harsh, the hamuz is a kind of psychological treatment, because when we're playing it, we're imitating the summer sound and the bird calls of the spring, and so we're summoning up the spirit of the warm weather in our villages and homes.
Aya Khan's leader Albina Degtyareva talking to Andy Kershaw for Radio 3's Music Planet. Well, everybody's been busy here on the stage, rearranging it, and here's Paul Rose to introduce the group itself.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, what about the Scrap Heap Orchestra? Hard to believe. Who'd have thought you could, you know, recycle an entire orchestra? Now, as Charles mentioned, you'll be able to see that performance again and the whole story behind those amazing instruments, how they were made, in a BBC 4 documentary, which will be shown later in the year. And there's also the chance to relive the rest of this Human Planet prom. It'll be shown also on BBC 4 on Friday, the 5th of August at 7:30. Well, now it's time to return to our journey from around the planet, from the vast open spaces of Mongolia, vividly brought to us by the traditional musicians of Usuktun. We now head even further north, to a land even more remote and unforgiving. Aya Khan came from the heart of surely the greatest wilderness on earth, Siberia. The group's three female musicians live in the capital of this region, Yakutsk, a city which lays claim to one of the world's greatest seasonal temperature variations, with a thermometer regularly topping 30 in the summer, and Yakutsk is also reputed to be the coldest city on Earth. To survive in these conditions, you have to be fully in touch with the nature around you and understand the dangers it presents. This was a theme that repeated itself time and time again through the Human Planet series, and it's one that musicians of Aya Khan are completely in tune with. The group's music is inspired by the sounds of nature, the howling of wolves, the calls of birds, the sound of horses, and the rushing wind, and the deep groans of the thawing ice in the spring. At the heart of their sound is the humus, or mouth harp, which has a great spiritual significance in Siberian culture. It's believed to have healing qualities, and during the harsh Siberian winters, it's played to summon up the spirits and ensure the return of the sun. So, you know, let's hope that happens. Could always use a bit more sun. We're going to hear two pieces by Aya Khan, both with a link to horses. They begin with My Horse. Yakut horses have a legendary reputation, being well adapted to the extreme cold, and it was ponies from this region of Siberia that Captain Scott chose for his ill-fated final expedition to the Antarctic. Aya Khan followed this with dedication to the blacksmith's patron, Kudai Buksa. In Siberia, being a blacksmith is more than just a trade. An apprentice blacksmith is obliged to demonstrate that he has acquired the spirit of a renowned ancient master blacksmith called Kudai Buksa. Now, when I first heard this group in rehearsal, I couldn't believe the natural sound they make. I was almost looking for some other instrument or tape recorder running around here, but it all comes from their throats. So from Siberia, please give a warm welcome to Aya Khan.
Өксөк кыл түйдебер геле хүңэр таңра бол бүтүрүңэй тоён үс бүрүктэ өндөлман каллантын жөгөй айыны орто туруудойдуга моолунанын телетевен туран эннелен хедилен бербит Кептүлэ манди насы кырсы гласы сыты да хлас насы бүтүр ман тул кужу баамирден өнкөлөр күн анар көрсүнөр тодуга масирак баанан баттаран кимдер бе
was Aya Khan, and their next song is a dedication to the blacksmith's patron, Kudai Baksa. Listen out. for the blacksmith sounds. A Siberian take on Verdi's Anvil Chorus. That was dedication to the blacksmith's patron, Kudai Baksha, performed by Aya Khan. Three young women wearing amazing traditional dress, long white skirts, black patterned overdresses with thick fur sleeves and gleaming headdresses and loops of mirrored necklaces. Well, now the BBC Concert Orchestra are going to return to the stage for the next sequence from Nitin Sawhney's Music for Human Planet. While they're getting set, let's look forward for a moment to the last of our Music Planet artists. They've come from literally the other side of the world, from Papua New Guinea. And in fact, this is the first time any of them have left their own country. They're the Bibalang Shark Calling Group. The shark calling was first featured in the Human Planet TV programmes. We saw Blaise Soka, the shark caller, attracting sharks by shaking a rattle in the ocean and by chanting songs to them. It took them some weeks to catch a shark, and when Andy Kershaw went over to meet the shark callers, he went out with Blaise in a small canoe to try his luck.
What are we doing, Blaise?
I was singing the song of the shark
or the spirit of Rosak will hear what I sing. I mention I'm calling them so that they will hear me singing loudly, and they will send a sack to me and I will catch it.
Singing to the spirits of the sharks, yeah, rather than the sharks.
Yeah. I sing to them and I ask them, I told them, we the sack calling people, we need sack to eat. And we want you people to give us a sack.
When you rattle the hoops of seashells into the water there, some people may imagine that that would not attract the sharks, but scare them away.
Oh, no.
No.
When I rattle the seashells, yes, and the shark will hear the noise of the rattle, they think that there is a tuna piece of fighting. The shark will come and eat the tuna piece.
Right. I see. That's the theory,
it's
anyway.
It's the way we attract shark.
Are the shark songs that the men sing in the village, are they supposed to help you catch sharks?
Yeah. When I travel out to make my shark calling fishing, the whole men will make their prayer and they will sing and make their sing to give power to me to catch shark.
Andy Kershaw going shark fishing with the Human Planet shark caller Blaise Soka. Well, sometime later they were still in the dugout canoe, still trying to catch a shark.
Yeah.
Looks like something of a mutiny on the Bounty. Palms and mango trees growing darker as they spread inland and then climbing up onto the mountains behind. Everything very lush, verdant. Okay, Blaise, what's the technique then for catching sharks?
When the sharks hear the rattles, yeah, and it came closer, I take the bait with a stick and push it down into the sea. We use fish.
Right.
And when the shark comes,
yes,
I used to trap it this way now.
So just as the shark was nosing the dead fish, you'd put the lasso round its head. Right.
And it comes closer, I pull it this way. Yes. Then I put a loop in it.
I see, you put the leather loop round its head. What happens then? It struggles until it's too tired.
It fights against me, and I hit it.
Well, before the shark callers take to the stage, more of Nitin Sawhney's music. And here to tell us more about it, Paul Rose.
Well, from Siberia, we heard the haunting sound of Aya Khan. Now, one of the things that makes us human beings so extraordinary is that we have managed to make our homes in such varied and diverse landscapes and climates, something few other animals can do. This is largely due to our supposed intelligence and extreme adaptability. In this next sequence from Human Planet, we're going to showcase two of the most diverse landscapes from the series. First, we head to the steamy jungles of Cambodia and the famous ruins of Angkor Wat. And from the Arctic program, we'll enjoy early spring in the most northern human settlement on Earth, Siorapalak in Greenland. To perform Man and Nature by Nitin Sawhney, the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Charles Hazelwood.
The BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Charles Hazelwood, in that sequence called Man and Nature from Nitin Sawhney's Music for the Human Planet. Taking us on the visuals on the screens here at the Royal Albert Hall, from a Buddhist monk in an ancient temple to a pod of whales to a birdcatcher on a mountaintop. So in a moment we'll be hearing our final Music Planet artists, the Bibelang Shark Calling Group, from a remote part of Papua New Guinea. It's been quite an event to bring them here. None of them have travelled outside Papua New Guinea before, and none of them had a passport, nor did they know any of those bureaucratic details necessary, such as their birth date. But happily, all those challenges have been overcome. They took their first trip in an aeroplane and arrived here in London a few days ago, being both amazed and a little bewildered, I think, to be transplanted into the centre of a big city. They've actually taken to wearing bits of leaf and twig picked up in Hyde Park, just across the road here, as apparently they were missing their native forests. Well, the stage is just being prepared. There are 8 performers in the group. A couple of them play guitars, others play percussion instruments that Andy Kershaw was talking about, made from seashells or other bits and pieces that they pick up on the beach. And they're a wide age range too, from mid-20s, early-20s, right the way through to older members of the community. So this is very much a community performance. And they're coming on to the stage now, dressed in their traditional outfits, with brass yokes around their necks and loincloths, and being warmly greeted here at the Royal Albert Hall, the Bibelang Shark Calling Group.
From Nitin Sawhney's score for Human Planet, we heard Man and Nature, performed by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Charles Hazelwood. Now, some of you will remember an extraordinary sequence in the Oceans episode of Human Planet, where a man canoes out to sea and calls sharks from the depths of the ocean using a coconut rattle. This extraordinary tradition from Papua New Guinea is closely interwoven with traditional music, song and dance, which is why the Music Planet team went to find the Bibelang Shark Calling Group. The group live on the glorious palm fringed shore of the remote Melanesian island of New Ireland. And this is the first time any of them have traveled outside their country. The Bibelang group was started by singer and guitarist Langan Daniel. First recruit was his father, Daniel Socker, who has a strong falsetto voice. To this, he's added the powerful tenor of their friend Tamal Gerard, who also plays guitar. Completing the lineup on traditional percussion, Michael Bob, Frederick Dominic, Hilary Albert, Peter Lawrence, and Albert Gregory. Peter and Alfred are also doubling as dancers and will be acting out the ritual of sharks calling, a story which was featured in the Human Planet series. Although the repertoire of shark calling songs is well known to everyone on New Ireland, remarkably, a moral copyright exists. And to have permission to sing songs from other villages, Langan's had to buy each of them from its owner for 20 kina, which is about £5. Thankfully, he did, because the performance we're about to hear promises to be a unique and memorable experience. Please welcome from New Ireland in Papua New Guinea, the Bibelang Shark Calling Group.
Yeah.
The title of that song was translated by the band as Killing People, a throwback to Papua New Guinea's not-so-long-ago headhunting days. Now an a cappella song about shark calling. Nasep Mat, led by singer Tamale Gerard, and with Sambalaman now, the shark caller loops the noose around the shark's neck. Sambalaman. And finally, Lulima, the shark is caught, and the village can enjoy a good feast. That was the Bibelang Shark Calling Group from Papua New Guinea. And during that last song, Alfred Gregory and Frederick Dominic were acting out the shark calling ritual, complete with wooden shark. Everyone here at the Royal Albert Hall certainly enjoying the diversity of music making from all the many cultures around the world featured on the stage tonight. And members of the concert orchestra joining in the applause for these visitors from the other side of the world. And the group taking one final bow. They're wearing magnificent feathered headdresses and giving us all a wave as they leave the stage. And as they make their way off, back on comes conductor Charles Hazelwood and the composer of the music for Human Planet, Nitin Sawhney, who'll be telling us about the process. I was talking earlier to Dale Templer, who is the producer of the series on TV, and she said that meeting Nitin, she knew that this was the man she wanted to make the music for this epic programme, and here he is.
Good evening. I'm Nitin Sawhney. Composing the music for the Human Planet series was an incredible privilege for many reasons, and here are a few. First of all, the central themes of human resilience and coexistence with nature resonated strongly with me and were a great source of inspiration. The scenes speak for themselves in telling our story with vivid beauty and thought-provoking sequences. These stories of human resolve and adaptation to the most extreme conditions are a feast for any musician's imagination. Secondly, the cinematography and production standards were so high, and these were the highest I'd come across in 20 years as a film and television composer. Although the idea of working closely with four very strong-minded directors and Dale Templer, the series producer, was pretty daunting at first, the experience itself was both exhilarating and uniquely educational. The music itself was composed in a blinding 8-week flurry of sleepless nights and determination to find a sound. This brings me to my main reason for being involved in the series. Not that one, this one. Finding a musical language that could express all the could bypass all the boundaries of nationality and politics was the greatest and most wonderful challenge I've ever faced. At first, we weren't sure how much orchestral work there should be in the music, but ultimately we needed an emotional subtext so universal that anyone could hear and feel it straight away. The orchestra became integral to that journey. And now, as well as the thrill of having the music performed here at the BBC Proms, I can also confirm a full orchestral Human Planet tour of the UK next spring. And so to the final piece in this Human Planet prom. We've called it Natural Born Survivors, and with it, we're showcasing each of the episodes in turn. We end with the Jungles programme, and probably the most evocative and thought-provoking footage in the series. After, I'm going to read from this. After nearly a year of negotiating, the team were given approval to film one of the last groups of people in the world who were still classified as uncontacted. The Brazilian authorities monitor these people because their way of life is under threat from illegal logging and mining companies. The Human Planet team joined one of their monitoring flights, and this final footage was a world first for the series. To conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra, please welcome back Charles Hazelwood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Natural Born Survivors, a final sequence from Nitin Sawhney's music for Human Planet, played by the BBC Concert Orchestra with their leader Cynthia Fleming and conducted by Charles Hazelwood. We've also heard five artists from Radio 3's companion series Music Planet who came from all across the world especially for this concert, and they're coming onto the stage now. From Greenland, Rasmus Lubert, from Zambia, Enoch Mbongwe, from Mongolia, Huzuk Tung, from Northern Siberia, Aya Khan, and from Papua New Guinea, the Bibelang Shark Calling Group, and people all around the hall are getting to their feet to applaud the diversity of performers. Incidentally, if you're concerned that our fascination with far-flung cultures borders on voyeurism, it cuts both ways. Members of Huzuk Tung were taking photos of the Scrap Heap Orchestra during the rehearsal this afternoon, proving, if any proof were needed, that man is the same curious beast the world over, with this prom exploring similarities as much as diversity amongst the members of the human species. But everybody crowded onto the stage. If you enjoyed the prom and want to hear it again, go to the Radio 3 website. You can listen again for the next 7 days. Or if you're within reach of London, why not come along to tomorrow's performance of the same prom, starting at 11 in the morning. And if you'd like to experience more of Human Planet and Music Planet, there's lots to see and hear at their respective websites, bbc.co.uk/humanplanet and bbc.co.uk/radio3. Just follow the links from there to Music Planet. Tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, a performance of Verdi's Requiem, with Semyon Bychkov conducting the BBC Symphony Chorus, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and the London Philharmonic Choir, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. That's live, of course, from the Royal Albert Hall, but with cheers ringing out all around me. For now, that's all from us here in Kensington. It's back to Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer. Well, coming up in a couple of minutes' time, Between the Ears, the programme follows a London taxi driver as he engages in a period of intensive meditation known as a summer sesshin in a Zen monastery. And then Here and Now is at 10:30. There's traditional music from Catherine Tickell, who performs new works based on Northumbrian folk tunes. Well, to take us up to the Zen monastery, here's music from the north of Europe. This is Sounds of the Nordic Islands, and this track is called The Flower of a Rose.
Thank you.
Flower of a Rose, a traditional song from Gotland in Sweden, performed by Vilu Veski, soprano sax, Tuut Kaluste, accordion, and the vocalist Eva Renglin. Well, now on Radio 3, another chance to hear an edition of Between the Ears. We join a group of Buddhists searching for silence in a noisy world in Summer Sesshin.
To take part in a sesshin, it's like taking the lid off a boiling kettle. It's sort of all this stuff just comes out.
It's a Japanese word, sesshin, made up of two parts, sesshin, and shin is the mind, but sometimes you can translate it as heart.
As soon as I sat in zazen, I was told, we don't move, and you don't do anything with your mind. You just allow your mind to be.
It's an anchor in which you tie a rope around sometimes and just hold on and think, okay, you know, this whole thing that we see outside, the noise, the people, it's there, but it doesn't actually penetrate. I started driving a taxi, actually. I started driving in 1990, started practicing probably about 1978, 1979, something like that.
Hi, it's, what's the time? 4:30, it's Friday afternoon, and I just had a very strange job whereby I took a lady from Marylebone High Street around the corner to Paddington Street to dispose of her recycling in a taxi, which kind of, I think the sense of irony was lost on that, because I said to her, is it a bit environmentally unfriendly to actually take a taxi to get rid of, like, seven bags of newspapers, but she seemed to think that she was saving the planet. That's interesting.
I first went in probably about 2003, 2004, and I went up to Sheringham in Norfolk for my first sesshin. And as a sesshin sort of comprises of 3 days of concentrated meditation. The wake-up bell goes at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning, and Zazen starts at 6:30 in the morning.
We're coming to a point of touching the mind, coming closer and more intimate with the mind, our true self, rather than what we think we are. So we're coming back because we've forgotten what we are. So that's what a retreat basically is about, to come back to that place again. You're on the underground or you're on a bus, that mind is still there, it's just that we've forgotten it. And our mind's busy thinking about something else. So we lose it, we lose touch, basically, we lose touch. So what we're doing is touching the mind again, we're coming back. So everything we do and the way we create the situation on a retreat is about coming back to touch that spirit, that mind again. Touching the mind again, we're coming back, touch that spirit, that mind again.
Behind that noise is a silence that is deafening. Once you experience that silence, you can actually enhance the amount of that silence that is there, if that makes any sense. It's and you can actually then discern what is just mental chattering.
Yeah, basically about how much noise pollution there is in London and how do you escape it? I mean, whether it be internally, like, you know, playing music, you know, so it drowns out the exterior noise, or whether it going away for a weekend or whatever you do, go swimming and avoid it. I mean, have you got any way, does anyone have any methods of escaping the sort of the continual noise of London?
Sleep.
So, okay, so while you're sleeping, do you have silence then? I mean, I'm interested to know.
No, actually, we'd have the TV on. TV. I fall asleep to the TV.
So that noise negates any other noise. Do you think that's right, or does it just make you go to sleep?
Yeah, it just makes you go to sleep.
Okay. Any other forms of relaxation that would suit, you know, a sort of busy lifestyle?
Smoking weed, I suppose.
So seriously, do you smoke?
I'm assisted.
So do you smoke a bit? Have a joint, and it
does.
I do.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. But don't you think, or do you not find that with smoking like that, it initiates other thoughts and a thought process whereby you're kind of, okay, yeah, you might not be taking in the shit that we normally deal with, but does it not sort of develop any other kind of feelings of anything else that?
The only feelings you'll get is it makes you hungry, that's about it.
Well, I say, the noise of opening the crisp packet or the Pringles box is... it's a killer, isn't it? Right, so...
Especially if you're snoring, Pambo.
Yeah, my snoring, eh? Boys, you shouldn't probably mention that. It was one night and only one
night. All right, mate, yeah.
It was only one night, mate.
Zen, in effect, is concentration of the mind. Zazen means seated. So it's seated concentration of the mind. And Master Deshimaru, his definition of what is Zen, he gave a definition of Zen as being, of true Zen, is sitting quietly in the right posture. And it means setting the mind at rest. So this mind that's always going, this chattery mind, setting that mind at rest. We don't sit directly on the floor, we sit on a cushion, which we call the zafu. And obviously the height of that zafu is very important because that affects the whole posture of the body. So there's two aspects to this. There's the body, the posture itself, which then affects the breathing and then the breathing affects the state of mind. So through the posture, we're influencing the mind.
It can be really hard, actually. It's not just physically hard, because obviously you've got the pain element of sitting still and your legs going numb, and, you know, it's the knee joints hurt, your hip joints hurt, your back hurts, your arm, you know, everything can actually hurt from doing nothing, really, which is quite interesting. But it's also, it's a mental discipline, and it's almost like, it feels in some ways like a bit of an avalanche of everything happening in your head. It's all moving.
Noise. You see, it's constant noise. And it's just, you know, and obviously because there was a lady who was asking me to put down the music, and I did. But there was still a noise. And the noise is coming from people, but on Friday night we do put the music up right there.
At this time I was, I guess it was, I was graduated, and I was kind of looking for something meaningful, I guess.
Yes.
Do you know that girl yourself, with the promotional, yeah?
Yeah.
She's all the chicken quesadilla and the other one. She thought chicken quesadilla is two dish, and she wants another dish.
Yeah, sure. Just ask her what she wants and ask Emmanuel to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And then I went to a retreat for 3 days. And funny enough, I still didn't know that this is Buddhism, because in Poland, the main religion is Catholic, and I guess I would be scared if I knew, but because I just first, my first encounter was that I just felt, that's what I kind of started to do. And then I went, and then right after the retreat I came to England, and the only experience I actually had is when I was studying and working in a bar, and then I started to work in a bar.
Someone asked me to turn down the music, but it's not the music, are the people. People make the noise. It's just, you cannot hear the music right now. But it's still noisy.
No, don't turn it off. Leave it quiet.
No, I did, but still, it's noisy. You okay?
Guinness, please.
Sure. What did he say? Oh, yeah, just choke it then. It was almost like having a double life. Because I was so different being here on a retreat, or, you know, like in meditating in London, and then being in a bar. It was like, I completely had to change my persona. I was presenting myself like from different angle, or, you know, I even changed my voice. Emmanuel, I need a cucumber.
Is you asked me to speak louder. I used to speak very loud at work because there's no other way. You know, when you want to communicate and the level of music is kind of, it's loud. It's then it's just you need to shout and I used to drink myself, and I used to go to a party as well, and then it's just like when you have drink or two, your voice rise and suddenly you're shouting because, oh yeah, look, and this is this, and yeah, and when you're meditating you actually
So a big part of our practice, especially when we're on a retreat, is that we do things in silence, as much as possible, bring the silence down without any unnecessary speech. So if we're chopping carrots in the kitchen, we do it in silence, as far as possible, unless you need to say, how does this need to be chopped? So that then brings the attention. So the point of the silence and being in silence is you bring your attention and concentration to what you're doing in that moment. And obviously your mind in those spaces, in the silence, is going to start thinking about, have I paid the gas bill, or what did I say yesterday, or I shouldn't have said that to the wife, you know, so my wife. So those things come up, but then you come back again and again and again. So the repetition comes back, come back, come back to the silence and the stillness. So in the same way we have meals, obviously, and the meals that we do eat, we eat in silence. And in normal situation there would be talking, conversations, but your attention would be on that conversation, not necessarily on what you're eating. And you could get to the end of a meal and think, what have I just eaten? I've forgotten. I don't remember eating anything. And that's the normal way people eat quite often.
Special curry, vermicelli noodles, chips and fried rice.
I work in a hectic environment in the kitchen. Serving customers. It's basically chef work. It's a Chinese food takeaway in Southport.
And a portion of chips. Anything else?
Fish and chips.
Oh, is it fish and chips?
Yeah,
chips. Oh, my hours are just ridiculous.
So I'm going deaf.
Split shifts, 3.5 hours in the morning, and roughly about 8 to 9 hours in the evening. And that's like 6 days a week. So as you can see, all my time's consumed. There's not much time for social life. One day off.
Customer collecting their meal. It's a phone order.
Because it's customer orientated. Because I'm dealing with customers. Customers are not always straightforward. So you have to make adjustments to fit around people. Somebody, I think it was basically he ordered fish, chips and peas. We've got to put the peas in the bag. He came back, about half an hour later, and just got really dramatic over a portion of peas. And he got really aggressive. So I responded with aggression, saying that, and he threw the peas at us, literally. And I thought, and he explained to us that, well, he had an argument with his wife over a portion of peas. It's like, wow, okay. You can have your money back if you like, I can't remember what happened, but we got in a bit of a, argument over a portion of peas, and he just walked off.
What did I say yesterday? Oh, I shouldn't have said that to the wife. But then you come back again and again and again. So the repetition comes back, come back, come back to the silence and the stillness. So the repetition comes back, come back, come back to the silence. So the repetition comes back, come back, come back to the silence.
I went to the Church of England school as in my early years. Everyone, I think, is on a spiritual quest or a philosophical search, looking for something or some kind of meaning of existence, of life. And yeah, I was a great believer in Christianity. Although I don't despise it, I was looking for something more deeper. I think the story goes was when I went to college doing motor mechanics in my late teens, I seen a poster of Master Dishimara on a door. So I just looked at it and I thought, I was really intrigued.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's difficult. I was brought up as a Christian. I very much wanted the Bible story to be true. It sounded great. it was very clear to and easy to be a Christian as a young person, because it told me exactly what was right and exactly what was wrong. All I had to do was do the right thing. That's nice, and it meant I didn't have to think too hard. I also probably didn't develop myself very much, because I didn't really ask many questions of myself. I just tried to make myself be a certain thing, be a certain way. And as I grew up and went through school and developed and walked around, looked at people, saw things, I found lots of things that contradicted the received wisdom I'd been given. I had to accept it wasn't true. That was very, very painful.
God is down, 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 down. God is fatigue.
No, God is fatigue. God
so
is
I
fatigue.
Want to help God.
I'm ordained as a nun. To take part in a session is just so important to me. All this stuff just comes out, and you have to sit there looking at it, and you think, really, is this? I've just thought this thought so many times. Wasn't this exactly what I was thinking in the morning? Do I have to think it all over again? And you realise how much experiences. You articulate your previous experiences to yourself. You tell the stories of your life over and over again. I think it's like dreaming.
You got really dramatic over a portion of peas. You got really aggressive. So I responded with aggression.
You tell the stories of your life over and over again.
When you have a drink or two, your voice rises, and suddenly you're shouting because, oh yeah, look, and...
You tell the stories of your life over and over again.
It feels in some ways like a bit of an avalanche of everything happening in your head. It's all moving.
And you threw the peas at us, literally.
Oh yeah, look, and...
Over and over again.
Buddhism is primarily about identifying our suffering, because us as Buddhists, we believe that to exist is to suffer. Working in London with the outside noise and outside visual stimulants that are there, you know, whether it be your mind can be set off quite easily by somebody equally driving badly in front of you, cutting you up, or a passenger getting in who's cross because they're late and expecting you to be able to turn time back.
I find when I'm in London, I walk so much faster and get huffy and arsy about people not walking at the same pace as I do.
So the more you understand the concept of time.
Getting in your way,
in that you cannot ever separate yourself from where you are right
around,
now.
I don't know, Oxford Street, meandering about, and then suddenly stopping.
Sometimes I've said to people,
behind them or
do you think you can be anywhere other than where you are now?
So,
and you will get your train if you get your train. That's all you can do. If you're late for your train, that doesn't mean you're anywhere else. That just means that the train isn't where you want to be. But that doesn't mean to say you've missed it. It's just that isn't where you're going. I said that to one person, they got very upset and said, what are you talking about? So I do stop, I have to stop myself from kind of being too philosophical, is that all right? Yeah.
If you sit in meditation long enough and regularly, then the only way I can describe it is that the inside of your head or your thoughts behave a bit like the snow shaker, where you know when it all settles down and then suddenly you're just left with clear substance, liquid inside of your snow shaker, but that's how your head feels almost, and it's cold.
I work with people with learning disabilities. They come and stay at the respite service that I work at, and I I find myself very, 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 very busy attending to people's needs in a very personal and person-centred way, being absolutely responsive to them. So it's a very draining environment, physically and mentally. It's an environment in which I can develop a great deal of stress. I can get headaches. I can come home and be unable to sleep. The things I've been seeing and doing constantly going through my mind.
I used to live in London. And when I was working in London, I worked in the city. I had a family, three children. I was working very hard as an IT consultant. And I got to the point where I ended up my arm paralysed and my leg paralysed. So I ended up going into hospital and they thought they'd got meningitis. And I thought, well, I'm going to go out of this place in a box. That's it, I'm finished. Eventually, I was sent home. After several weeks in the hospital, and I went to a library and I saw a poster. There's a poster for Zen, and there was a picture of Master Deshimaru.
So, do you mean to say that real, proper concentration and realization is or should be spontaneous?
Yes, you must come back to normal condition.
It said introduction by this woman, Nancy. Nancy Amphu. So I went along and she talked about the practice and then got some cushions out, the Zafus, and it was absolute agony. And she pushed my back and straightened me up. And I'd been paralysed a few weeks before, and here I was sat on this Zafu. We got outside and she lit a cigarette. She's a nun, and she lit a cigarette. I thought, this is really strange. It is a nun. I was shocked. It is a nun lighting a cigarette. And then she said to somebody, get me some beer. So
about 10 o'clock, there is a big gap, which if I'm not drinking, and I'm not drinking when I'm working, then it's just like I cannot really... It's like I'm knocking to a shell and there is nothing inside.
I was so unhappy. And I thought, when in my life was I last actually happy?
So the mental anguish I used to suffer came primarily from myself, because we set ourselves up with almost like a movie in our head that we kind of direct, we star in, we produce the whole thing.
I thought, the last time I was happy, I think, was when I was about 10. And I was quite happy being myself, running around in the garden, making bows and arrows out of bits of hazel twigs and stuff. And
if our life doesn't follow that pattern of our presumed progress through the world, then we feel that we've either failed or it causes us unhappiness because we're not where we think we want to be.
And so I thought, well, I'm going to do what pleases 10-year-old Heather.
When you realise it's an illusion, and that behind that illusion is the real person, it's not the perceived person, or it's not this sort of model, this photo kind of composite person that we think we are. I mean, you know, the image in a mirror is not you at all.
I'm going to do what pleases 10-year-old Heather.
my unusual combination, contrast, my unusual combination of interests. I do all sorts of different things. 6 years ago, I started playing Brazilian African drumming. And from playing there, the person that leads it is Zach. And Zach, one day, he said, oh, how do you fancy coming down to play bass with this Afro jazz band?
Yeah, where we play is in the middle of noise. It's very noisy, but it's a noise which harmonizes. Each one of us, we are harmonizing a noise. And you have to be concentrated for the next beat because you can lose the next one. It's like a meditation.
Well, I mean, I was in the middle of a session, so I was in the middle of a week's retreat, and we actually had a gig on the Sunday night, and I left actually up.